in the last episode of Timeline, The Disappearance of Cassie Compton.
I found a gray and blue woman's boot just laying there in the grass. It shouldn't have been there. There's no reason for a gray and blue or any woman's boot to be back there where I was.
I showed a picture of it to the mother. The mother says that's not hers.
You had been saying she's never been ruled out as a suspect, so...
It is being resubmitted for a DNA.
There is still no sign of Stuttgart teenager Cassie Compton.
It's like part of me is missing because she is my blood.
No one has been ruled out as a suspect.
I mean, literally, half a block away, poof, vanish, nothing.
We love you, and we just want you home safe.
After 5 years, the tips have really dwindled.
She just did so many things that were suspicious.
I feel like somebody knows and they just won't tell.
Hello, everybody. This is Kayla Lafferty. About a month after the podcast was released, my news director, Nick Genty, got a call from the Independence County Sheriff, Sean Stevens. He left a voicemail saying he wanted to talk about how his office was being portrayed in the stories that ran on our station, and Nick told him to call me. It had been about 3 months since I first reached out to the Independence County Sheriff's Office about setting up an interview with Brandon Rhodes. As I'm sure you remember, he was in a relationship with Cassie Compton's mother at the time she disappeared and is booked into the Independence County Jail on charges unrelated to Cassie's disappearance. He wrote me a letter saying he wanted to bring closure to Cassie's case. I hadn't heard anything back from the jail or the sheriff at the point that the podcast came out. When Sheriff Stevens called me, he said he didn't get any of the voicemails or messages Nick and I left for him, but that he didn't have a problem with us talking to Brandon. We asked if we could make it a formal interview and bring a camera and record the interaction. He said he and the county prosecutor decided not to let us record it. The reasoning was that Brandon still has charges pending in Independence County, and they also said for safety reasons we were only allowed to interact with Brandon through glass. I called Tina Storrs from Halo's Investigations and told her that we were going to be able to meet Brandon face to face. She lives in Olive Branch, Mississippi, which is almost a 3-hour drive from Batesville, Arkansas, where the jail is. It took some planning, but we decided to meet with him on a Thursday at the jail. We both arrived on that Thursday at 10 a.m., All we brought inside were our IDs, and I had a notepad and pen to take notes since we wouldn't be allowed to record the interaction. We walked up to the front door of the jail and pushed the intercom button to tell them we were there to see Brandon.
Go on the door.
Thank you.
We walked into the jail for what was supposed to be an hour-long meeting with the prime suspect, Brandon Rhodes.
We just spent, what time is it? We walked in there at like 10:05, it's almost noon. Mm-hmm. So we spent almost 2 hours in the jail talking to Brandon, Tina and I. And it was a very interesting experience.
When we went into the jail, we were met by the jail administrator. She walked us down a hallway and into the visitation room. It's a long, skinny room with 4 seating areas that face a window where the inmate is supposed to be. There's a chair at each window, so Tina pulled over a chair from another area and we sat down next to each other. To the right side of the window is a black phone on the wall. The jail administrator then warned us that the room tends to get really cold. She then left us alone waiting for Brandon. After a few minutes, he walked up led by a corrections officer. He was wearing an orange jail-issue jumpsuit and his wrists were shackled at his waist. He sat down and tried to reach for the phone but couldn't because his wrists were shackled. He then walked away for a moment and came back without the handcuffs. He sat down in the plastic chair and motioned for me to pick up the phone on my end. He then picked it up and dialed a 6-digit number and a recording played that said the call would be monitored and recorded.
So we're sitting between glass with a phone, and he walked in his orange jumpsuit. He had his hair, his hair's long and it was slicked back in a bun. Mm-hmm. And there's like a chunk falling out in the top, and he had a little bit of facial hair, and he's gained a lot of weight since his mugshot.
Totally, he looks
He different. Looks way different. Yeah. Like, I don't know if I would have recognized him if I saw him walking down the road. So when we started off, the first thing he did, he brought in a notepad. And he was writing notes, because it's the phone, when he starts to talk to us, it says, like, your conversation is recorded. Right. So he wrote a notepad, and the first thing he did was he wrote down, he's got issues that need to be handled, and he needs two things. He needs access to a lawyer and a library, and he held it up to the glass for us to read it. And he kept doing that throughout the whole, our time talking to him. He would write certain things down he didn't want recorded to tell us, which was kind of crazy. But let's just go over some of like the big things that you that you remember, that really stood out to you, Tina. There's a lot that he talked about.
The first thing that stood out to me is when we sat down at the window and Kayla introduced herself, and then she introduced me. And as soon as he heard my name and saw me, I mean, like, it was a total shock.
He looked
very like
a ghost. He saw a ghost.
Yes. And then he had wrote to her that he had two issues, and he wrote two things down on the paper.
Yeah.
And one was me. And
he wrote Tina Halo's PI, something about like not trusting you.
Right. There was two things he didn't trust. It was what the government.
Yes.
And me.
Yes.
Tina and I had both been in contact with Brandon through letters, but up until the moment that I introduced Tina as Tina Storrs from Halo's Investigations, he had no idea we were working together in telling the story of Cassie's disappearance.
You asked some questions, and then when I got in there to talk to him, I explained to him that I thought that it was better for me to come and be face-to-face with him so I could see him and he could see me and we could fill each other out instead of just writing letters to each other. And he did agree to that, and he was very happy and very relieved once he figured out that I wasn't the PI, the person that was coming after him, going against him.
And we should have done that just first, because that first, like, 20 minutes I was talking to him, he was very closed off and speaking very, like, I would ask him a question, and he would just... He would, like, what were the words he was using? He was like, I will not elaborate on that.
Yes.
He kept saying over and over, I will not elaborate on that.
A lot of terms, you know, where you can tell he's been studying, which will come up, too, at the end of one of my things that I'd made a comment about. Mm-hmm. But when I did get on the phone and you were talking to him, he answered you, but he was very safe at his answers.
Yes.
But I was able to trigger him a little bit more. Would you not say?
Yeah, totally.
I was able to trigger him a little more because I just went into the case and he would come back with an answer, and you've got some of them there that he would come back and do.
Well, let's start off talking about one of the first things we asked about was Judy, like his relationship with Judy, why their relationship ended. I asked him about, all he said is that woman deserves answers, is what he kept saying.
Yes.
And I asked about the letter he wrote me, and I was like, well, in your letter, you said that you wanted to come clean and give closure to Judy. And his response was basically like, because I know what happened, but I didn't do it, and I'm not going to say what happened to her because...
Right.
He had this long explanation that we can get to.
Right.
But he says on the night she went missing, I asked him, like, okay, well, what happened on September 14th?
Right.
And he paused for probably 30 seconds. Do you remember he kept doing that where I'd ask him a question? He would pause and he would, like, lean back and stretch his arms out like this.
Yes.
And then take a breath and, touch his eyes before he would talk. Like, there were certain things where he would do that about.
Yes.
And this was one of those. So he said he says Judy was sick. He said that he was in the back bedroom with her.
Yes.
That he never saw Cassie. He said that she came in, grabbed something, was there for less than 5 minutes, and then he heard the door. And so then...
he walked outside. Isn't that what he said?
Yes. And that he had walked outside and a couple minutes later and she wasn't there. That's all he basically said on that. I asked if he remembered what she was wearing, and he said, oh, no, I didn't see her, so I don't know what she was wearing.
Right.
And that's pretty much all he said. But then he went on to talk about, I'm trying to read. I was writing so quick.
The one thing that when he said that he was inside and he did not see Cassie, you know, we have to look at that aspect of, this is a whole nother story now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because this is not what was said.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now he's saying he never saw her that night when
right.
all of even the interviews he did, like that Judy was doing with Channel 7 while
right.
Brandon was sitting there.
Right.
Was that he was cooking breakfast for dinner.
Right.
And that she was in the back bed.
Yes, and he doesn't remember cooking breakfast.
He says he doesn't remember that, but he said it could be possible.
Right.
But he says he doesn't remember that at all.
Right.
And then I asked him about what his relationship was like with Cassie.
Right.
And he got quiet for a second, and then he called her Little Miss. He said Little Miss seemed quiet, but she had raging hormones. He kept going on about that, about how basically she had a temper. And when I asked him, because a lot of people have said that night that Brandon, there's been like rumors and speculation that Brandon took his bike after, so Cassie comes home at like 6:55. Supposedly
right.
she's gone by 7.
Right.
And then at like 9 p.m., Brandon rode his bike to Stuttgart police supposedly and tried to report her missing.
Right.
But that's not written down in any records, so we haven't really reported that before. But I asked him about that,
right.
and he said, he doesn't remember having his bike and that he has no comments on anything related to SPD, Stuttgart Police Department. And then he wrote down on his paper and held it up saying that they had harassed him, that Stuttgart Police Department has been harassing him about all that stuff. And then he goes on and on and on, and I wrote down kind of quotes of what he was saying, that the U.S., in the United States, it must be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, and there has to be evidence to tell a story, what did he say? Oh yeah, this is the part where he's going on and on about how there has to be evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt to prove that there's like evidence that like whatever happened to Cassie happened, and there isn't any of that evidence. And then he was going on about how it's time for him to move on from the case, which then later he changed his whole story on that.
Right, and you know that it's came into 5 years that Cassie has came up missing. Well, in 2 more years, Judy can declare her deceased.
Yeah.
So once the declared deceased, if Judy decides to do it, then he can talk.
Is what he's saying. But that doesn't even make sense to me
right.
why that would make a difference.
Right. Maybe, but he did also tell us that a murder and certain things, there was no limitations
statutes
on it.
Statutes of limitations.
No statute of limitations on it. He was private about a few things that he did not want out in the media, and he wanted to make sure for, I guess, safety issues.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not for just him, maybe for, you know, I'm just saying in general.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
I know.
I have notes. This out.
I have notes.
But,
he said when I'm asking him, because I asked him just like straightforward, like, people are saying that you killed Cassie. You had something to do with her disappearance. Like, what do you want people to know? And he said, I have my faults, and like pointed to his jumpsuit. Like,
uh-huh.
I have my faults, saying like
right.
I'm in prison or I'm in jail right now. But he says, I'm not such an animal to be guilty of what she thought, meaning Judy, because Judy had said something to him.
When Cassie came up missing, the first words were from Judy, is where she at?
To Brandon,
where she at? And he said, as soon as Judy said that to him, he knew then how she felt about him. Because how could she feel and ask him that when he was trying to be a stepfather, I
yeah.
guess, to her. And he wasn't a stepfather figure.
Mm-hmm.
And that Cassie would come to him and ask him things, and he would set her down and talk to her and say, this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it needs to be. He said, and he would try to do it like that more instead of a person that would take control over her, I guess, with
mm-hmm.
spanking or doing, you know, anything like that you would do
yeah.
with a teenager.
Yeah.
So,
and he says that he has step parents, and so he took the role of like basically raising Cassie very seriously, and that's why he never could have done anything. He looked at her as like a member of his family.
Right. And he would even talk to people and ask people, how do I deal with this?
Yeah,
yeah.
Is what he said. Because he said that he said basically he has the mentality of a soldier, that he's lived a life that is like put had to what he was saying was that he, the trauma he's faced in his life basically has made him have to be a soldier, and someone that's been through that sort of thing is not a fit parent. So he said that, like, he shouldn't have been a parent and he shouldn't have been really raising Cassie, but that he took it upon himself to do that. Which I thought was kind of interesting as well, because he's kind of saying, like, I shouldn't have been in her life, but I was. I also asked him if he believed Judy knew anything, and he said, like, no way, I don't believe Judy had anything to do with this.
He said, what was it? One thing that Judy could not ever do would be to...
To act.
That she wasn't fake.
Yeah.
That everything she does is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the soldier mentality. And then when I was like, do you know what basically happened? And he said, over his dead body, that he would never let anything happen to a member of his family.
Right.
Which is what he was saying there. And then we went on to the part of the conversation with, like, seeing him face to face and how he's like, can put a face to his name, and now he trusts us more to talk to us. And he did say a lot more after that. I asked him again. You asked him, this is the part where you were on the phone just going through my notes, and you said, okay, well, Judy's saying that night that she was sick and you made breakfast for dinner and that you brought her breakfast in bed and she had those dizzy spells and stood up. Then when you asked him about the car,
he doesn't recall.
He says he doesn't recall any of this.
Then I asked him about the car. I said, I was told that you went to get cigarettes and Cassie had went to get cigarettes. And he made it clear to us that there was a way that we could find this out and answer all of our questions, but he couldn't tell us on the phone.
And he said, he did eventually say that Judy had paid for some insurance company thing.
With Progressive
that basically tracked where her car was, and that investigators, if they really were looking into the case, would have looked into that night and figured out if he had taken the car or not, which he had claimed that he didn't. And
he would have told where the car went, the miles on the car.
Yeah.
It was numerous things that it would tell. So if they would have checked into it, they would have known where that car was and where it was at all times.
Yeah. Another thing that I wrote down because it stuck out to me a lot. He said that he has been through the places and things that he thinks Cassie might have gone through on the night she disappeared.
Yes.
And I was like, what does that mean? And he's saying basically, like, well, I've been through trauma. Like, I've been through experiences in my life that are similar to what Cassie might have experienced the night that she went missing, which made me kind of pause and be like, what do you mean by that? And he went on to say that he's going to wait until he's out of a secure facility to give us the information that he has. And he just kept saying that over and over again.
Right.
And I was like, but you're saying that you understand what happened to her. Like, you put yourself in a position to feel what she felt the night she disappeared, implying that she was murdered. But he wouldn't elaborate on that anymore, because I was like, what do you mean?
But
like,
he kept saying, I have your address, and when I get out of here in 1 year or 2 years or whatever, he said, I will be seeing you.
Yes.
Which, and he said, you cannot have your camera, you cannot have your telephone.
And Androids. He specifically said iPhones or Android cell phones cannot be brought to this conversation.
That it would be me and him. And nobody would be allowed, and I would not have any way to, like, make contact with anybody. So he would be there.
Yeah, and I was like, okay. And then you asked him, because we could tell he's not going to give us information about really what happened that night. Every time we'd ask him, we would be like, he would kind of say, like, oh, I'm not going to disclose that, or I don't remember. It's been 5 years. I don't remember. So you asked him, do you think it was a safe neighborhood that they lived in? Was it safe for Cassie to be walking around like people said she did, and that there were other sexual predators, like, in the area? And then that's the part where he says he had advised Cassie what she should do in certain situations.
Right.
And then he did talk about how he thought that Cassie was on drugs.
Yes.
And he had mentioned that.
He had mentioned that methamphetamines and puberty and different things like that. If you're going through a stage of a teenage life and you get hooked on methamphetamines, it can make you go beyond what you need to go and do things that, that you wouldn't do.
I wrote this down because it really, it made me, it like gave me goosebumps when this happened. When he was talking about that, he said that he would give her advice and try and tell her, don't do this, like, don't be doing these drugs, don't hang around these people. And then, what was he talking about? He was saying that he would sit her down and give her advice on how to live her life. And he paused and shivered, like physically shivered. Like he went like, ugh, and then kind of continued talking. And then you brought up, so right as he was kind of shivering, you brought up, Judy said that she fears that Cassie never left the driveway.
And he said.
And he said, personally, that's hearsay.
Yes.
Personally, and I wrote down that quote. You can't read it because my handwriting's awful. Personally, that's hearsay. I believe that to be true. I've investigated a lot of people.
Right.
And then he went on to say he has a list of five people, five individuals that he believes could have killed Cassie. And do we...
I wouldn't say a name, but he...
Yeah.
He believes that that she could have been picked up right at the driveway, that there was somebody there waiting on her. It was a stage on saying she was going to get a smoke. That was her way out.
That was interesting.
Yes.
So, because you brought up, well, you know, police have a text messages basically where Cassie had texted the guy that dropped her off saying that she was going out to get a smoke.
Right.
He says he thinks that Cassie sent that message as like a...
It was a setup.
It was a setup so that people thought she was leaving to get cigarettes when really she was doing that to throw people off as she was going to meet up with someone she shouldn't have been meeting up with.
Right, because he said he believed somebody picked her up, that she didn't go far, because right when he noticed that she was missing, he walked outside, he looked around, and she was gone. And there was no way that she just went walking. And I asked him, I said, did you take the car and go get cigarettes? And he would not answer us.
Nope.
And that's when he told us about the Progressive deal.
Yeah.
Where.
Yeah.
But also, when this was said, there's a tobacco store right around the corner from Judy's house.
My news director, Nick, came with us to the jail to record our interactions after talking to Brandon. He jumped in to ask us a few questions.
How believable is he?
I don't think he's believable at all. And there were certain things where we would ask him and he would pause for like 10, 15 seconds before giving us an answer. And I think he had a lot of like physical tells, I want to say, where he would like touch his eye weird and like pull it to the side or like stretch out, trying to act like, oh, this is nonchalant, this isn't a big deal, we're talking about this.
Right.
But then there were some points where he was almost getting like emotional talking about Cassie being like a victim of someone else.
His eyes would kind of get a little glassy there a few times. I feel that if he wasn't in jail, we might get more.
Yeah.
I feel like we would get more. But I do feel that he's being really, what would you call it, preserved or whatever.
Yeah, really reserved.
Reserved because of the fact that things could happen. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it's still an open investigation. He's made it clear multiple times that he's a prime suspect.
He said, I have that right here.
Right.
Well, this was, I asked him point blank, well, if you didn't kill her, what are your theories as to what happened? And he's kept saying, since, you know, the phone call's being recorded, he's saying, I'm not going to say it through here. And he would take a long pause and write on his notepad. And he wrote the notepad up and held it. And it said Guatemalan human trafficking.
Right.
So his theory is that Cassie was sold into sex trafficking and she's somewhere in Guatemala, which I don't know. I feel like it was almost like him trying to get us to talk about a different subject.
But there's also a thing with porn, with child porn. Mm-hmm. He made it clear how sickening that he felt. You remember that? He made it clear and he was like, maybe you need to search into this aspect of it. And he made it clear that it made him sick.
Yeah.
And then there was a thing that was made up when he had made a comment and he said, and I mentioned, yeah, there's something really bad when it comes to a grown man interested in watching a kid 7, 8, 9, and 10 years old in these porn sites. Mm-hmm. And he got kind of emotional a little bit and said he understood that.
Yeah.
Just from listening to you two, sounds like Brandon's trying to deflect a lot.
Yeah.
It could be this, it could be this, it could be this.
Because he did not bring up the possibility of sex trafficking until we talked about halos and how you investigate sex trafficking.
Right.
I don't know if, because like that first 45 minutes, the topic of sex trafficking was not brought up until you got on the phone with him and were talking about how you investigate and you look for these things. And then all of a sudden he's saying Guatemalan sex trafficking. He also claims he's a private investigator and has spent hours upon hours out in the field doing field work, talking to people and following people, investigating these people he thinks were involved in Cassie's disappearance. And he also tied that into why he's in jail here.
Right.
He claims his arrest in Independence County, which the story in the affidavit of probable cause was that some person paid him $300 or whatever to follow this person's wife to kill them. He says that's basically not what happened, that he had a firearm, he's a felon, he had a firearm on him because he's being surveyed because he's doing private investigator work on Cassie's case. And so he said that
he wanted to be in jail.
Yeah, so that he had the gun to protect himself, but also wanted to go to jail because he's being followed by people and harassed. So him being in jail was protecting him from the people that are threatening to harm him because of Cassie's disappearance. He was all over the board with the stuff he's talking about. And a lot of the stuff he's saying don't really tie together.
There is a thing that he did make a comment when he said the child porn in Guatemala, that it was a lot going on. These people were being shipped, okay? And there is a lead at the moment that I hope is being checked into. And I sent you the picture.
Yes.
That last picture that I sent you that site.
We can say on that is, I mean, Tina's job is to investigate human trafficking.
Investigate.
So you look through those pages, back page or whatever those websites are that are notorious
people don't
want to
look. I look into all sex trafficking sites, which there are tons of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have to go on porn sites and look and see if it's the girl that's missing or the girl that's being trafficked out.
Yeah.
So there's numerous things we do, and it's a lot. It's not for everybody,
No. You
know. So, and some of it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see a 10 or 11 year old child being sex trafficked out, and they're making videos of it, and they're selling them on sites, and people are buying them, and much less the kids being trafficked at that age, and the men are buying them.
Yeah.
So.
And I haven't reported a lot on this angle, just because a lot of it's hearsay and speculation.
Right.
And as a journalist, you have to have things substantiated to be able to report them. But you look at these sites on hours on end looking for people's pictures that look similar to people that you're looking for. And you found a picture that, I mean,
it's spot
eerily
on.
Looks
spot
like
on.
Cassie.
Spot on.
And there's been a couple that, that looks like it could be Cassie. But this picture that you had was, it gave me goosebumps when I opened it.
Yeah, actually, when I sent it in to law enforcement, they wanted to know where she was because they were going to go in. And I told them it's not that easy because it's not an escort site. It's a porn site. So they're going to have to go a little deeper into finding out where the porn site's done, where the porn, everything's going on. So it's not something I can do. That's going to come into a higher step up than Stuttgart.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to do it. It's going to probably have to be FBI, sex trafficking ring, divisions and all that. But if it's not her, it's unbelievable.
It's incredible how similar.
What did you hear, either one of you, that A, stood out, or B, you hadn't heard yet?
We found out about the boot.
Oh, the boot. Let's talk about the boot. Oh, this is great. Okay, I have this written down. So you asked him what boots was Cassie wearing, because he claims in the beginning, he says he never saw her that night. He says, I didn't see her. I was in the room with Judy. I heard her come in. She left a couple minutes later, never saw her. And you asked her, or you asked him, okay, so what boots did Cassie wear? And he kind of looked at you and you're like, you know, we've been hearing that she was wearing these boots or whatever, and the boots were gone. Like, what did they look like? Were they blue? Like, and he goes, they were teal.
Right.
And he's like a greenish, bluish teal color. And you're like, were they gray and blue, or were they tan and blue? You tell kind of more on this.
I asked him, he said, is there anything else you want to ask me? I said, there's one question. And I said, Cassie's boots. And he looked kind of funny, you know, for a minute. And I said, were her boots blue and gray? And he said, teal and gray, like a steel gray.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. He said, why? Did you find some?
Which we all know, as part of the update episode I did, episode 7,
right.
Steven Serrani was out in the woods.
Right.
All we know is in the area of where her cell phone pinged, so somewhere kind of near Casco.
Right.
That he found a boot out in the woods, and that he noticed that it matched the description.
Right.
So he, called Stuttgart Police. I did that whole thing where I talked to Steven about that situation. Stuttgart Police waited like a year or two or whatever to go find this boot.
Right.
But they do have it in
they
evidence.
Said that they do have it in evidence.
They say they're going to send it in for
yes.
DNA testing. But Brandon, him asking, why do you have it? Did you find a boot?
He said, did you find a boot? And I said, no. And he said, so why? And I said, because there's rumors. I said, when we make a flyer up and put a description of what the missing person is wearing, I said, these boots have been mentioned. I said, but multiple people are saying, blue and gray and blue and brown. Okay. And I said, so he said, no, they were teal. The stitching was teal. They kind of had like an eagle.
Yeah, he said that. And as he said, did you find the boots? I wrote this down. He touched his eye again like this. He kind of stretches his eye like this. So right as he asked, why did you find boots? And he like touched his eye, which he did several times throughout our hour,
right.
Almost 2 hours talking to him.
And so I told him that they were blue and gray. He said gray like teal. And I said, okay, well, when this boot was found, they had asked the mother, was this boot hers? And the mother said no. So they didn't do DNA on it. Nothing was done. But supposedly they have the boot.
They asked the mother if those boots were Cassie's.
Yes. Okay. They asked if they were Cassie's boots, and she said no. Then she changed and said the boots were blue and tan. Blue and brown.
Yeah.
Well, he stated no. They were teal blue and gray.
And this was before that happened, but that whole thing really stood out to me. Like that was, I was kind of like
he just perked up like, did you find boots?
Did you find boots? Did you find boots? And was like touching his eye, which really just stood out to me. And then I got back on the phone because we had to like switch off who was talking. And I talked to him for a good 10 minutes, and the entire time he was talking about how people think he's a psychopath. And that was kind of interesting to me too. He asked me what I think makes a psychopath. And so I told him, from what I've read, it's a mixture of nature versus nurture and some whatever. I just said basically whatever. And he was going on and on and on about how it's pain that creates a psychopath.
When he was talking about, I talked to Cassie about drugs and, being promiscuous, things like that, did you feel like he was trying to make it look somewhat like part of this is her fault? She started running with the wrong kids. She was out having sex and she was, do you think he was trying to say, a little bit of this is on?
I think so. And I think that at the time that she went missing, when they were able to get into her phone stuff, Judy had found messages that Cassie had text people, and one was, don't worry about me, I'm working this side of town. So working this side of town, what does that mean? And then him stating that he believed she was getting into the methamphetamine part of it, and she would do what she had to do to get what she could get, his exact words. And he didn't agree with it, but she was going to do what she wanted to do. There was no control in Cassie.
She's 15. Right. I also think that whole part of the conversation was also him trying to paint himself as a caring stepfather,
right.
A caring man that was doing whatever he could to make Cassie's life better. And
right.
I could never do this because I cared for Cassie. And look, I was trying to help her. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to make sure she wasn't making these bad decisions and blah, 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 blah. So I can see it both ways.
Yeah,
like, I can
right.
see it as him maybe trying to paint it like, well, Cassie was doing all these bad things, and so, you know, she ends up disappearing, like it's on her. But also, I think he's saying that stuff to try and make himself seem
right,
make us empathize with him.
And well, I saw multiple personalities going on.
I mean, he changed
through him.
He changed like his demeanor,
right,
depending on what we were talking about.
Yeah. And when I told him that that letter that he wrote me, I did not write him back because I did not think he wrote it. That's when he wanted us to know that he was told by psychiatrists.
He said by multiple different psychologists.
Yeah, that he was,
diagnosed with multiple personalities. Yeah. The reason this came up was, and I talked about this, I don't remember what episode of the podcast, but the first letter I got, his handwriting is so bad.
Right.
It's super hard to read. There's misspellings everywhere. It's like there's no punctuation. Every letter is capitalized, or every first letter of the word is capitalized. Like it's really hard to decipher. His second letter, perfect cursive, big
right.
words, like legal mm-hmm. terms. So it's like, I thought for sure he had a lawyer penning these letters for him, like what he was saying, a lawyer writing it versus the first letter.
Right.
So you bring that up and he's right. like, he said, I don't want to say it over the phone. So he wrote it down. Psychologists have told me I have multiple personalities due to PTSD from what's happened in my past. That's
right.
what he said, word for word.
Another part of our interview with Brandon that I wanted to talk about involves other suspects in the case that we haven't mentioned before. I said to Brandon, if he thinks he knows who may be involved with Cassie's disappearance, why doesn't he just come forward with the information and get it solved? That's when Tina had an idea.
So we're not going to say those five people's names that you wrote down.
Right.
Because we're not going to name anyone as involved with right. this that might not be.
Right.
But Brandon said he had five people's names that he was investigating.
Right.
And that you wrote down five people's names as I'm talking to him.
Yes.
And we switched places. You held up the names.
I held up the names.
And he was looking at them, reading them. He gets to the fourth one and just explain his expression.
It was just like a deer in headlights. Like he just stopped and he looked up at me and it was almost like it was kind of a scary look, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
It was kind of a, and I knew right then, and then he told me number four, and when he told me number four.
And it's a name you've brought up to me before.
Yes, and it was a name that was given to me after we did the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe we're on something.
Yeah.
I do believe that we're getting there.
What are your thoughts on Brandon after this interaction? Do you think he was involved?
Well, with the sociopath deal, mm-hmm. there's a possibility. Because if he's got multiple personalities, what personality came out in him that night
mm-hmm.
with the teenager? But
yeah.
he's stating he didn't see her.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, it's a hit or miss.
Yeah.
It's a hit or miss. And but when I saw that name, it's something triggered me.
And
because who's easiest to blame is him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And let him be the main suspect, because he's done so much to make people think that it's possibly him.
Yeah.
And if somebody else did it, it would be a good setup.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, here you go. If you have a sociopath and you got multiple personalities, what personality happened that night?
Yeah. And on that note, I mean, he spent probably 5 minutes explaining to me why people think he's a psychopath or sociopath. And
right.
so and so. And then when I ask him, well, are you a sociopath, psychopath? He's like, what? No, what? But
yeah.
he's staring me dead in the eye, trying to intimidate me
yeah.
into basically believing he's a psychopath, I think.
Right.
Which I don't know. Who knows? I think he's trying to talk a big game.
Right.
But also, let me just say, I have a copy of his mental evaluation for these charges he's in Independence County for now. And he was deemed mentally competent to stand trial here in Independence County
right.
for those charges.
Right.
And I mean, this evaluation goes through his past.
Right.
I mean, it talks about all sorts of stuff.
Did you get the impression he was trying to
he was smarter than you guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, but when he talked to her, he talked to her different than he did me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it was like with her, he did a lot of Bible stuff,
yes.
You know, and tried to do scripture stuff and how he was a man of God now.
I
mean,
he spent half the time talking to me about quoting Bible verses.
Right.
Saying, yeah, he's a man of God. And he said he's ordained by God himself.
And then I had made a comment about, studying law. And he like got real offensive and said, how did you know that? How did you know that? And I said, because if I was on the other side here in a suit, I know what I would be doing. I would be in the library and I would be doing everything I could for my innocence or whatever I needed.
Mm-hmm.
But he got very like, who told you? Who told you?
Like you knew he was studying law or something?
Yeah, and when I told him I didn't write him back for the letter he wrote me, because it was all like, we thought it was a jail attorney.
I mean, that's in the podcast. We thought for
right.
sure that
we
it was.
We thought it was a jail attorney that wrote it. But he did say his signatures change. His writing changes with each letter. It
if
depends
he really,
on what personality he's
if
in.
If he really wrote both of those letters, then I'm blown away at how different his handwriting is.
Right.
Depending on how he wants to write. Because,
yeah,
I mean,
it's
like polar opposites. It's crazy.
Toward the end of our time talking to Brandon, he left us with some thoughts about the future of Cassie's case.
He asked me, like, well, do you believe me almost? And I was like, it's hard to be honest. And he got kind of defensive. And that's what incited the whole psychopath conversation.
Right.
But then in the end, I was like, well, if you say you're not involved, you say, yeah, you identify that you're a suspect, but you say you didn't kill her. Well, do you think she's alive? And he sat there and paused for a long
right.
time, looked down, looked back up,
right.
took a deep breath, and then he said, no, I don't think she's alive. But
right.
then he's also spewing all of this sex trafficking.
But then he's like, it's been
stuff.
5 years. You know, I've seen things happen. I've seen things 5 years down the road. No.
Yeah.
But he's made it just so clear that if he gets 1 to 2 years, he's going to meet up with me.
I know.
And tell me everything. So that's weird.
Yeah.
Kind of scary.
I know. That is scary. He did say that he's like, well,
I will find you.
He claims that his charges are being reduced here in Independence County and that he's only going to be in jail for a couple years. And then he said, I'm going to find you, Tina. And we're going to have a face-to-face conversation with no cameras, no phones,
cameras,
no recording
no
devices.
Phone, no nothing. He said it'll be a one-on-one.
Tina and I both wrote statements about everything that happened during our conversation with Brandon and gave it to Stuttgart Police for their investigation with Arkansas State Police about Cassie's disappearance. Brandon asked Tina and I to stay in contact with him for however long he's in jail after his trial for the charges in Independence County. He says he wants someone to check up on him to make sure that he's okay. At the time of her disappearance, Cassie had blonde hair, blue eyes, weighed about 100 pounds, and was 5 feet 3 inches tall. She had a noticeable scar on her left cheek. If you have any information about what happened to Cassie or where she may be, please reach out to the Stuttgart Police Department.